this is the last lecture, so let's have some fun. So I decided to go for black hole thermodynamics. So part D will be black hole thermodynamics. And as I advertised already, this is just a bonus lecture, so it will not be part of your interview. It's just for fun. So black hole thermodynamics. All right, and so what I would like to do is that basically I would like to give you some historical overview of what happened and why we think that actually there is thermodynamics of black holes. But I will also show you some interesting calculation, which basically will use some techniques which you learned yesterday in your quantum theory course. All right, so let us start gradually building towards the thermodynamics. So first, the motivation. And so we already know one black hole, which is the Schwarzschild black hole. We know it has some strange properties. We know that everything freezes on the horizon from the perspective of outside observer. We know that there is an infinite redshift on the horizon, and so on and so on. We know that underneath the horizon, actually time and radius switch their meanings. And so actually the metric is dynamical underneath the horizon, as we discussed in tutorial yesterday, and so on. So anyway, so now let's look at some of the properties of the Schwarzschild black hole. So we have Schwarzschild black hole. And let me just remind you once more, this very important metric is minus f dt square plus dr square over f plus r square d omega square, where f is 1 minus 2m over r, and omega is simply the element on the sphere. D omega square is sine square theta d phi square plus d theta square. So that's the metric element, and that's the only vacuum spherically symmetric black hole there is. All right. So now let's study some of the properties of this metric. So first we know that the integration constant m, which appears in this metric function, is nothing else than the mass of the solution as perceived by a distant observer. So okay, so the properties are that we have the asymptotic mass, or if you want, like an energy of the spacetime, energy of spacetime. And it's simply given by this formula. Well, it's m, right? But you can also write this m in terms of the horizon radius. So if you look at this thing here, so when is the horizon? The horizon is where f equals to 0. So it's r plus is equal to 2m. So in other words, I can write m as r plus over 2, right, in terms of the horizon radius. Okay, but this is the asymptotic mass, this is the asymptotic energy of the spacetime. All right, so that's the first property of the black hole. Another property is the surface gravity. Okay, so we have asymptotic mass, and then we have surface gravity. Gravity. And so let me just tell you some strange words and some strange definitions. And then let me just tell you that this is basically what you would expect. This is something like a Newtonian gravitational acceleration, but evaluated on the horizon of the black hole. Okay, so that's basically what you should be thinking the surface gravity is. So in other words, it's the acceleration the rocket has to actually exert so that it stays on the horizon. So because of the infinite redshift, what do you expect for this acceleration to be? It will be infinite. So actually, if I want to stay on the horizon and I don't want to fall inside the black hole, such an acceleration is infinite. But if I go all the way to infinity and redshift that, I get a finite value. That's what this surface gravity really is. But anyway, so let's go from here. So what is true is that the black hole horizon is a killing horizon. Let's just use that word, killing horizon. Which means that it is a null surface generated by a killing vector. Okay, so what that means is that, well, you can have time-like surfaces, you can have space-like surfaces, and you can have null surfaces. So space-like surface would be something which looks like this if this is time and this is space. So it's mostly, you know, it goes in the space direction. That would be the space-like. So this is a space-like surface. Time-like surface will be something which goes mostly in the time direction. Okay, so time-like would look like something like this. This would be time-like. And of course, null surface is something in between, so it actually has to exactly go under 45 degrees if you are in Minkowski space. So the null surface is this one here. So now, looks like this. So the statement is that the surface R equal to R plus is actually a null surface. It's the one, well, along which the light actually travels. And so what we are saying is that this null surface is generated by some killing vector. That means that the killing vector is actually tangent to it, or normal to it, doesn't matter. These two things actually coincide. So this is our killing vector, which actually generates this surface. So it's tangent to that surface. All right. So for our Schwarzschild black hole, this killing vector simply happens to be the time-like killing vector. It's just k equals to dt. Okay, so for Schwarzschild, k is simply equal to the static killing vector of the Schwarzschild solution which we have. All right, so now what you can show is that if you have a killing horizon, so meaning a null surface which is generated by a killing vector, then this killing vector is actually also a geodesic. Okay, so the k thing is actually null geodesic. Okay. Is a null geodesic. You can show that for any killing vector, this is true. Okay?
What about the partial theta and partial phi?
Okay, so partial theta. Partial phi is certainly another killing vector, right, which is our axis symmetric killing vector, but it's not the one which generates the horizon. So you could perhaps find, no, probably not in Schwarzschild, but you could perhaps find a surface where d phi killing vector, which is generated by this d phi killing vector, but it wouldn't be null, or it wouldn't be. Okay, so here we require two things. We require that it's a null surface, meaning it travels under 45 degrees, and that is generated by a killing vector. And so you know, okay. So for care, there will be some combination of dt and d phi, which will generate our horizon, but for Schwarzschild, it's just this thing here. All right, so it's a null geodesic. So what does it mean? It means that if I actually write down the geodesic equation, well, so this is my nabla k of k nu. So this might be equal to zero, that will be a geodesic equation. But I'm also telling you that it may not be equal to zero, and it's still a geodesic equation. Okay? And so you can also write that it's equal to kappa times k nu, where this is some function of the coordinates. And so as long as the derivative is proportional to the velocity itself, this is still a geodesic equation. Okay? But what it means, the presence of the right-hand side basically means this originates from the fact that we are not using the right affine parameter or whatever. So it's non-affine parametrized. Okay. And unfortunately, this non-affine parametrization is precisely what actually is called surface gravity as a formal definition. All right, so if I take our killing vector dt, and so I calculate, well, it has to be geodesic. You can show that it has to be geodesic. But this geodesic in general is not affine parametrized. And so I have this right-hand side, which is non-trivial. And kappa is precisely called what is called the surface gravity. So kappa here is the surface gravity. That's a very abstract definition, right? Well, OK. You can calculate it from here. This is your equation for kappa, right? So we know what k is. We just calculate the left-hand side, calculate the right-hand side, and identify kappa. Well, it's not actually that simple, but almost that simple. OK, so what you find is that kappa is given by, well, metric function derivative with respect to r evaluated at r plus divided by 2. OK, so that's what you find, is that I have my metric function f. I have to differentiate it with respect to r and evaluate on the horizon. That's what you find. OK, so let's do it. So f prime, OK, it's a disaster. So it's 2m over r square, 2m over r plus square divided by 2. So it's given by either 4m or by 1 over 2r plus, whichever you like more. OK, so. That's the surface gravity. OK, so now this was simply we introduced some very abstract quantity here. And, you know, we calculate that this surface gravity goes like 1 over r plus. So now I told you, let's consider the Newtonian gravitational acceleration on horizon. Okay, so the Newtonian gravitational acceleration, well, A is mass divided by radius square. So if you are on the horizon, it's mass divided by r plus square. Right? And so it's precisely 1 over 2r plus. OK, so this is indeed, you should be thinking about the surface gravity as something which is like a Newtonian acceleration on the horizon. But of course, it is infinite, because I have to keep my rocket there, you know, pushing an infinite acceleration. But if I go all the way to infinity, this gets redshifted, and it gets a finite value. And this finite value is precisely this one here. OK, so this is, of course, a sort of a coincidence, but the lucky one. So anyway, so we have this very abstract quantity here. We have the surface gravity. And basically, it tells you how strong the gravity is on the horizon of the black hole. All right, so finally, we can calculate how big the horizon is. So we can calculate its area. OK, so. Finally, we can calculate horizon area. All right, so how do we do it? So we look at our metric. And so our horizon, let's consider it at t equal to constant. So we just freeze time. And we know that r is equal to r plus on the horizon. So we freeze the radius as well. Right? So then our metric, ds square, well, dt, the first term dt square is gone. The second term is gone. So our ds square just reduces to r plus square sine square theta theta d phi square plus d theta square. Right? That's what our metric element reduces. And now we want to calculate the corresponding area, the corresponding volume. Of course, the area is just given by the determinant of this metric, square root of the determinant of this metric, times d theta d phi. So the area is just given by an integral over determinant of this metric Okay, let's call this metric differently. Let's call it gamma. The determinant gamma, or whatever, gamma. The determinant gamma d theta d phi. Okay, so that's how you calculate the area. And of course, how we constructed this is that we said we are in the area gauge. So actually, what we are calculating is just the area of the sphere. But because we chose the area gauge, the area of the sphere is just 4 pi r squared, which you can immediately see from this formula as well. So the determinant of the metric is just r plus to the 4 sine squared theta. If I take square root of that, it's r plus square sine theta. R plus square sine theta, d phi, which is, of course, 4 pi r plus square. Okay, that's how we constructed the whole thing. Right? So we have the area, we have the mass, and we have the surface gravity. Okay, so now let's do an experiment and let's calculate the differential of the mass. And let's calculate the differential of the surface gravity of the area. So now observation is that if you calculate the total differential of the mass, well, mass is just r plus over 2, so it's dr plus over 2. So it's 1 half dr plus. Let's calculate the differential of the area, so dA. Well, you have to differentiate this one. It's 8 pi r plus dr plus. Okay, and then we have kappa, which is 1 over 2 r plus. Yes?
I'm just wondering, so our r is not constant anymore?
Our?
Like, r plus is not constant anymore? We're like saying like small
d. Ah, wait, no. So, okay, very good. This is a very good question. So, of course, for our black hole, if it is as it is, r plus is a constant, right? So it's simply the radius of the thing. So now what we are really doing by this observation is that we are considering some physical process. So maybe we actually want to throw a particle inside a black hole. Okay, if you throw a particle of some small mass inside the black hole, my mass will change of the black hole. So this is what we are doing. So now we are changing the mass. And of course, if we throw in some particle, the area or the black hole will get bigger. Right, so the area will change, right? So this is what we are doing now. So this is like a physical process. We throw in a particle, for example. This was a very good question. Throw in a particle, and so that in the end, you know, some properties of the black hole will change. Okay, so we are considering dm, and then we are considering dA. And then we know what kappa is, and then it's super simple to verify that actually you find that dm is kappa over 2 pi dA over 4. dA over 4. Well, check that, right? So dA is 8 pi r plus, over 4 is just 2 pi r plus, and kappa is 1 over 2 r plus. So that better give us dr over 2, and it does. Okay, so then we find this observation. Okay, this is what a first law of black hole mechanics is. Okay, this is the first law of black hole mechanics. So basically what you are finding is that if you throw in the particle, you know, the mass changes according to this formula, which is given by the change in the area times basically the surface gravity. That's what you find. Okay? We just derived this. Questions? Yes?
Because the Newtonian calculation that we did is at the horizon, whereas we are integrating that quantity in the black hole case at infinity.
That's right.
Also, it's parameterization dependent. So.
Yeah. No. Okay, very good. So, of course, I'm cheating here, right? I'm cheating here. So it's not really a Newtonian acceleration, right? But you should be thinking about it as an Newtonian acceleration. So of course, there's a long way, you know, showing how these two are related or whatever. And they cannot be related, right? One is Newtonian theory, one is full general relativity with, you know, in extreme conditions, right? So they cannot really be mapped one to another. So I'm cheating here, that's for sure. But you should be thinking about surface gravity like the strength of gravity on the horizon. That's correct statement.
Is there a more
formal definition? So, what do you mean? So this is a formal definition. So it's just I take a Killing vector. I see it's not, the geodesic equation is not affine parametrized. This is how I define what kappa is. But of course, now I can start with this definition and I can show, you know, where else kappa appears, right? And so, for example, where it would really appear is that if I'm interested, so let's say I have a particle standing on the horizon, okay? So then I connect this particle by an infinite rope, massless rope, all the way to infinity. And then I have a muscle guy there who wants to hold that, who wants to hold that rope and hold that particle on the horizon. Okay, then precisely the force the guy at infinity has to apply is small m of the particle times kappa. That's the force applied at infinity in order to hold this particle on the horizon. Okay, so that's where else kappa would appear. And that would really tell you it's like an acceleration, but it's redshifted acceleration from the horizon to infinity. All right. So we have that. So now, more formally, black holes do not have to be just Schwarzschild black hole. We mentioned yesterday that we can have rotating black hole, Kerr black hole. But in fact, you can also have a charged black hole. You can put some electric charge, and you will study charged black holes today in your tutorial. So more generally, we have the following laws of black hole mechanics. So our general black hole can actually rotate. So it's described by the mass, but also the angular momentum J, and also by the charge, if you want. This is the electric charge. For astrophysics, the charge is not important because if you had a charged black hole, the surrounding plasma would discharge the black hole. Okay, so you always attract the opposite charge, and so in the end, black hole would be really uncharged. So what people think is that that really charge is not interesting for astrophysical black holes. But for theoretical black holes, yes. All right, so general black hole has these three charges and nothing else. That's the Noether theorem which we discussed yesterday. Okay, so then you have several laws. So the Zeroth law. So this was, by the way, formulated in 1973 by three gentlemen. So it was Carter, Bardeen, and Hawking. So Bardeen was here recently. I don't know if he's still here, but you can talk to him. Of course, Hawking has died, but Carter, I think, is still alive. So anyway, that's the famous paper from 1973. Zeroth law says that the surface gravity, kappa, is a constant on the horizon, right? So that's not obvious from the definition, right? If I just write the geodesic equation, kappa can be a function of x, right? So that can be some function. But the statement is, actually, it's not a function. It is a constant. OK, that's the first statement. That's the Zeroth law. So the first law is a generalization of this thing here. But now we have also charge, and we have also the angular momentum. So then we have dm equals to kappa over 2 pi dA over 4, and then plus omega dj plus phi dq. And that's it. So that's how the first law looks for general rotating and charged black hole. So we already understand these two terms. So this is just how, so let's say I throw in a particle which carries some angular momentum, right? So then the angular momentum of the black hole will change. Okay, so there will be some non-trivial dj. And what stands here is just the angular velocity of the horizon. So in the same way as we have here the surface gravity of the horizon, this will be the angular velocity of the horizon with respect to infinity. But also my particle can carry some charge. And so the overall charge of the black hole will also change. So there will be some non-trivial dq. And the corresponding quantity here is just the electrostatic potential. The difference of the electrostatic potential on the horizon and at infinity. So this is the electrostatic potential. Of course, if you have a charged black hole, it produces some electrostatic potential that changes from the horizon to infinity. And the difference between the horizon and infinity is this phi here. All right. Yes?
So for the zeroth law, are we still considering a process that changes the horizon radius?
So
that it's a constant.
No. So here I'm just saying that kappa, which I defined over here, for a stationary black hole, will be simply a constant. If you have actually something just passing through the horizon of the black hole, of course the process, well, the black hole is not really stationary. The black hole is actually highly dynamical because I'm throwing something in, so the horizon sort of bulges in, then it absorbs the particle. And so in that very instant, this will not be true. Kappa will actually depend on where on the horizon I am, because of course when I'm absorbing the particle here, there the kappa will be different than everywhere else. But after a short time, this will just thermalize. And so then kappa will be constant again.
Right, but it will be a different.
It will be a different kappa, of course. Yeah. So this is for a stationary black hole. A stationary black hole, which is precisely the black hole described by Kerr plus charge. All right. So that's the first law. Then you have the second law. And basically what it says, and was proved by Hawking, that classically the area of black hole never decreases So this is provided that we have some reasonable processes where some reasonable energy conditions hold. So in particular, where provided some kind of energy condition, the energy condition here was used, that it's a null energy condition holds. I didn't tell you what it is, so it doesn't make sense to write it. But anyway, this is the classical result. So provided the matter actually satisfies some reasonable properties, then in the process of absorbing a particle, the area of the black hole will simply increase. Okay, so it never decreases. All right. So finally, there is a third law, which is still subject to a debate. And that simply says that I cannot actually decrease kappa to zero in a finite number of processes. So it is impossible reduce kappa to zero in a finite number of steps. All right, and that's it. So these are the three laws of black hole mechanics formulated in this paper, or four laws. And what is super interesting here is that people just, the paper only involves geometry, right? So they just consider black hole, which is described by the geometry, by the metric, and then they just do geometric considerations. And so nothing here is, you know, using quantum theory or is nothing using anything else than geometry. A proof. So proof is completely geometrical. Proof, completely geometrical. Okay, but so this is just a pure geometry. But of course, if you've taken any course on thermodynamics, well, then you see that these laws are precisely the same as the four laws of thermodynamics, provided that I say that the surface gravity is something like the temperature, and that the area is something like the entropy. So, but, you know, intriguing. Would be to say that kappa is something like the temperature and that the area is something like the entropy. Well, that would be super intriguing, because if that is the case, then this is well-known thermodynamic laws as you know them. You know that a body in equilibrium has the same temperature. It's assigned one unique temperature, which is a constant. And then you know that D of energy, the first law, is equal to temperature times the entropy, dS, plus some work terms. So these are just the work terms, right, which are not so super interesting for thermodynamics. But you would have really dm is dds plus some other thing. And then you know that the entropy actually never decreases. And then you know that actually, it's impossible to reduce temperature to absolute zero in a finite number of steps. So now this will be super, you know, tempting to say that really this must be the case. But of course, classically, it is not. So classically, black hole can absorb things, right? It eats everything once the things get underneath the horizon, they are simply eaten, right? But it never emits anything. Okay? So, but classically, this is not the case. Black hole simply acts as an absorber. It's a perfect absorber. An ultimate sponge, right? Perfect absorber, which does not emit anything. And so, classically, the temperature of the black hole, of course, is equal to zero. So T is equal to zero, classically. So, you know, although it would be super tempting to say that, you know, this is just whatever we know from thermodynamics, a simple argument tells you that classically this is certainly not the case. Okay, so that was the situation in 1973. But in the meantime, Wheeler, who is this famous figure of basically the founder of general relativity and the father of general relativity in Northern America. So he asked his PhD student, so this is the case. But what happens if actually I throw a cup into a black hole? So the cup originally had some entropy. So now I throw it inside the black hole. The black hole is at zero temperature classically. So I cannot assign an entropy to the black hole. So where did the entropy go? Right? So I started with an object which has some entropy. I throw it inside the black hole, but now the total object has no entropy. How is this possible? Okay, so then there was this origin of black hole thermodynamics. And really, at the origin of the black hole thermodynamics was this Wheeler's cup of tea. So the question was, which was basically assigned to his PhD student, was, you know, where does the entropy go? If you start with an object and you throw inside a black hole, and so that object was had some entropy originally, so where does it go? And so Bekenstein was fighting with this idea, and so then what he showed is that actually it's not true that the black hole can be assigned a zero entropy. Actually, the entropy which you throw in, well, is sort of preserved. In fact, it actually enhances. And what he argued by some Gedanken experiment is that the entropy of the black hole actually has to be proportional to the area. So that's what he actually showed based on this idea here. That, you know, based on this question, he showed the entropy actually has to be proportional to the area. Okay, but of course this is crazy, because then you are really tempted to say that the black hole has temperature, but you know it doesn't. So then it took a year until actually Hawking considered a calculation where he considered basically quantum, where he took the quantum effects into considerations. And then he actually found, so then comes a historical year, Hawking, 1974. Hawking, 1974, and he basically, you know, took quantum effects into account, and then he showed that actually the temperature of the black hole is indeed proportional to the surface gravity. So now let me restore all the things. So we have kappa over 2 pi, which is what I was writing, but it was in natural units. But if I restore all the units there, then there will be h bar here, and there will be k Boltzmann here. Okay, so that's how the temperature formula looks like. But you know, once you have that, you can really use this first law to fix what the entropy is, and you see that the entropy, so this is the temperature kappa over 2 pi, so now this must be the entropy. So now he could also say that he could improve on Bekenstein argument that it's not only proportional to the area, but it's area over 4. Okay, so then it follows that S is actually area over 4, and then now if you restore the units, it's 1 over h bar g newton. All right, so that was Hawking's amazing paper. So what he really did, he did something very suspicious. So what he did, so he said, well, this is the horizon of the black hole. That's my horizon, r equal to r plus. Okay. And then what he did is that he actually sent some scalar field to the black hole. So he sent some scalar field. And of course, you know, he sent some scalar field with some amplitude or whatever. Okay. And so of course, part of this scalar field sort of, you know, went inside the black hole, and part of it scattered and went back to infinity. And so then he was looking at this observed value or whatever. Not really observed, right? But anyway. So what he actually realized is that you send some amplitude here and you get a bigger amplitude there. So actually there is an amplification. Okay, so this is like a simulated emission. Okay, and so he calculated how much it is, and then he basically derived the distribution, and he concluded that the black holes actually, they radiate as black body. So black body radiation. So now what is the problem is this calculation is that in order to get, you know, this stimulated emission, your scale of field really has to go close to the horizon. It has to probe the very vicinity of the horizon. But of course, we already know that the things, if I send something in a finite frequency here, it gets infinitely blue-shifted as I go close to the horizon. Okay, so then actually you get modes which are so much blue-shifted that they exceed the energy of the universe, right? But of course, what he did is that he used the quantum field theory in Kerr space, which is a technique where you say the space-time geometry is simply fixed, and then I consider small perturbations from small quantum fields, you know, on this fixed space-time geometry. But of course, if you have something so blue-shifted close to the horizon, then you have huge energies. Of course, huge energies affect the geometry. So then actually you cannot really trust your calculation in the vicinity of the horizon, because everything is so blue-shifted that the geometry will certainly be affected. Okay, so this is the problem. And so this was criticized by, for example, Bill Unruh. And so Unruh didn't believe this. Well, he sort of believed the result, but he didn't believe the actual calculation. And so he had to come up with his own calculation when this problem does not exist. Okay. So, but anyway, so since then, actually, this result was confirmed by many, many other calculations and very, very different techniques. And it was reproduced in string theory, not really, and in loop quantum gravity, not really. And it was reproduced by many other, in many other theories. So now we actually believe that indeed, the black holes, if you take quantum effects into account, they have temperature, which is something like surface gravity divided by 2 pi. And they have entropy, which is area over 4 for the horizon. Are there any questions?
Can you go over those? Like, how did QFT help with the calculation? I didn't quite.
Oh, no. So what you have to do is that, so the classical calculation will be, I send some classical field there, that field gets scattered, and okay. So then, that's not what you are doing. You have to take quantum effects into account. So you have to quantize the field. So you actually send a quantum scale field there, and then you measure the quantum theory there. So how you describe this is through the technique which is called quantum field theory in Kerr space. You will see that in cosmology course or in quantum gravity course. And you will see how the calculation actually goes, I hope. So then, you know, you will see explicit details of this calculation. But the problem is that what you assume there is that really the quantum fields are really teeny tiny, and they are basically like, they don't affect the geometry at all. The geometry is fixed from the very beginning. It's a Schwarzschild geometry. But that won't be true near the horizon. So near the horizon, the fluctuations or the effect of the quantum field is so big that you cannot neglect it. Other questions? All right. So as I said, you may see this calculation in all glorious details in one of the courses to follow. Instead, let me go for a shortcut and let me show in a few lines that actually kappa over 2 pi is something like temperature, and S is proportional to area by Euclidean trick. So this was developed by Hawking. Many people still don't believe that this actually works. Penrose is one of them. But of course, Hawking is quite ingenious. And there was even a debate, and you can there's a book published from this debate between Hawking and Penrose, where Penrose is very skeptical. And he says, you know, this is nice, but probably not justified or whatever. And Hawking basically says, I invented that, so it must be true. So let's just do this by Euclidean trick. Verification. And, you know, whether this is really a proof, it's a question. But, okay, so you already know from quantum theory that if you have a thermal green function, it has periodicity in imaginary time. Okay, so recall that the thermal green functions have periodicity in imaginary time. Or Euclidean time. So what you do is that you take your normal time, t, and you go from, you do a Vick rotation on that. So you introduce a new Euclidean time, tau, which is I times t. So tau is the Euclidean time, and t is your normal Lorentzian time, and you just do Vick rotation on there. And then you find that if you have actually a green function and you evaluate it at your in your imaginary time, in your Euclidean time, then if this guy has a periodicity beta, then you say that this is actually a thermal green function. Okay, this is a thermal green function. Was this discussed yesterday? Maybe.
Does that have anything to do with the KMS condition?
With which condition?
The KMS condition.
With KMS condition.
I don't know, it's something very similar. It's some periodicity.
Okay. Then you answered yourself. Probably yes. Okay. And so if you find this, then actually beta is related to the temperature by 1 over so the periodicity is related to the temperature T by 1 over T. Okay, so that's the statement. So basically that's the definition of thermality in quantum field theory. Okay, you just say, I just calculate my green function, and I find it's periodic. So if it's periodic, it corresponds to a thermal state of this temperature. So that's the first statement which Hawking was using. Second statement is that you can calculate your partition function you can calculate from knowing what your Euclidean action is. Okay, so you have your solution. Now you do this transformation to the Euclidean time. Okay, and then you calculate the corresponding action. And the statement is that the partition function is just a path integral over this action. Okay, where the weight is this action. So now let's do it for gravity. So then we have z. Of course, in this case, the path integral is over all the possible metrics. Okay, so then this is something like d of metric e minus Euclidean action of that metric. Okay, that's how your partition function looks like. And but of course, we don't want to calculate this exactly. Nobody knows how to do that. So let's just do it in the first approximation, in the WKB approximation, where you say that this thing is dominated by the classical solutions, and that's the only thing which actually contributes. So WKB approximation is that you say this is just minus e to s Euclidean g classical. Okay? So that's how you calculate your partition function in the first approximation. You just take the classical metrics, and you evaluate the action on the classical metric, and this is your partition function. All right. But you know, once you have the partition function, then you can do statistical physics as you are used to. So you can calculate the free energy. So the free energy is just minus 1 over beta logarithm of z, which, okay, if I take logarithm of z, it's just the Euclidean action with a minus sign. So this is just s Euclidean divided by beta in our approximation. Okay, so all we have to do to find the free energy, this is the free energy, is to actually evaluate the Euclidean action on a classical metric and divide by beta, and that's our free energy. And then what I was doing in the front end, once you have the free energy, you can calculate anything you want, right? Just using this thermodynamic machinery. So in particular, the entropy is simply given by minus df over dt. Okay, so this is how you calculate the entropy. Yes?
Can the WKB approximation work? Because in that path integral, you're taking, damn it, what boundary conditions does that path integral have?
Ah, whatever, right? This is so wrong that, right?
And that Green's functions that we're talking about there are what? Our scalar field that we're sending.
Okay, I'll show you what I'm doing, right? So okay, so let's just, you know, this is some idea, right? So let's just try to apply it to our case of the black hole, or actually for the black hole, the calculation is a little bit complicated, and you will see it hopefully in the gravitational physics course, maybe. So let's just do it for something simple. Let's just do it for Rindler, which is our favorite space, right? So let's just do this. So let's try to do this. Let's try this for Rindler. Okay, so hopefully that it will become clear what we are doing. We will not really calculate any green function. You will just look at the metric, actually. All right, so, okay, so the Rindler space again is just this thing here, minus 1 plus a x square dt square plus dx square. Now let me put dy square plus dz square so that we have four-dimensional result. Okay, so that will be our Rindler space. All right, so that's the metric. So now, instead of calculating Telmer green function, or instead of calculating any green function, we're just trying to apply this to the gravitational field itself. So to the metric here. So the first step is to actually do the big rotation on our Lorentzian time capital T. Okay. So first, we do a big rotation. Where we say that our Euclidean time tau is just I capital T. Oh, this is unfortunate because that's not a temperature, it's just a Rindler time capital T. All right, so what happens? Well, the only appearance of T is here, right? So this just switches the sign. So our metric now becomes ds square is plus 1 plus a x square d tau square plus dx square plus the other two terms, right? So now we treat this basically as our Telmer green function. So anyway, so that's the metric how it looks like. So now the next step is to simplify the metric a little bit by introducing some new coordinate. Okay, so now we do a change of coordinates so that it looks nicer. Of coordinates. And so what you do is that you introduce new coordinate rho, which is given by 1 plus ax divided by a. Well, why not? So that's my new coordinate. And if you do that, of course, the rho is just dx, because I multiply by n divided by a. So I have that. Oh no, what is it I'm doing? D rho dx. Well, it's good. Very good. So now let's just write this. So what is this equal to? So now this is equal to a square rho square d tau square plus d rho square plus the other two terms, right? Once we change these coordinates, I'm just getting something like rho square here, a square, rho square, d tau square, whatever, right? So now, of course, this is completely Euclidean. Now the metric is Euclidean, it has plus, plus, plus everywhere, right? All right, where is the original horizon located? So our Rindler horizon was located when this guy vanished, right? So the Rindler horizon is when this thing vanishes, which is precisely when rho is equal to zero, right? So, finding this. So So now the Rindler horizon. Rindler horizon was located in 1 plus a x equal to 0, which is rho equal to 0. Okay. So now, what is true about the original Rindler horizon is that we know that it was actually not a true singularity there, that we could actually extend through there, and there was really no singularity there. It was just a coordinate singularity. Okay, so this Rindler horizon was non-singular in the first place. Let's assume that this is the case also after the Euclidean rotation. Okay, so originally non-singular. So it better stays non-singular again. So better stays non-singular now as well. Non-singular again. Okay, so the question then, the big question was million of dollars is this metric non-singular when rho goes to zero? Okay, and to this purpose, let me just do another coordinate change. So I will say that now I introduce a new coordinate phi, which I just define a times tau. Okay, let's just do this coordinate change. Then what is my metric? My metric is just the rho square plus rho square d phi square plus a flat piece, which is not interesting. Okay, well, how does this metric look like? Are you familiar with this metric? The first two terms? What is that? Sorry?
Spherically symmetric?
Oh, it's just polar coordinates or whatever, just the two-dimensional things, right? So this looks like, I don't know, dx squared plus dy squared, but now in rho and phi coordinates, right? So this looks like a polar, like flat and polar coordinates. But of course, this will be only true when something happens. It's only true when, well, rho goes from 0 to infinity, that's fine. But the angle phi better go from 0 to 2 pi. Okay? Because if it doesn't go from 0 to 2 pi, then I have a situation like this. I have a cone here, and I have a tip. Well, I have a singularity, conical singularity in the top. Only when phi is equal to 2 pi, I can actually move it to the plane, and then it's completely non-singular. So this would be true only if phi has periodicity of 2 pi. Only then the origin of my coordinates rho equal to 0 is actually non-singular there. Okay, but what it means, well, I demand now that phi is, so what I demand is that phi has periodicity 2 pi. But of course, what that means is that the Euclidean time, tau, has periodicity of what? Of 2 pi over a. This is what I have to demand. But comparing with whatever we demanded for the Euclidean thing, we demanded that the green function, in our case the metric, if it has the periodicity, this periodicity is related to the temperature. Okay, so what we just derived here is that actually the Rindler space can be assigned a temperature. Assigned temperature which is given by T over beta. So this was our beta, right? So this is what our beta was. So T which is a over 2 pi. This is the unroot temperature of the Rindlow space. So in other words, you know, if you start accelerating the vacuum fluctuations, your Minkowski space doesn't look empty anymore. Rather, it looks like filled with radiation, like body radiation, with the temperature which is proportional to your acceleration. Okay, isn't that an amazing conclusion? So, of course, how you verify that is that you start running super fast, and then you see, and you carry that chicken with you, and you see that you can fry the chicken as you accelerate super fast, right? Okay.
Special suit so you can fry.
Okay, so that's so we just derived that the Rindlow space is a temperature. But, okay, if you did the same calculation, yes?
How do you see that there's the acceleration from the quadrature? But I mean, we know this when it's temperature. I mean, how do you arrive at the conclusion that's the
acceleration? No. So we started with the metric, right? We know what A is. A was the acceleration of the observer, right? So I just recalled that we have the Rindlow space. We start with the Rindlow space. The Rindlow space corresponds to an acceleration who sits at x equal to 0, and t is the proper time. But the observer is accelerated by the acceleration A. That's his acceleration,
okay.
Right? And so now we just show that because of that acceleration, the observer sees the temperature T.
Is there no way we could have found another change of coordinates that would give us another periodicity, and we say, oh, we have found a periodicity, and it's...
I have no idea. You can try. I doubt it. I never tried. I don't know. But I don't think there is. Okay, so we have a temperature. Amazing. So if you did the same calculation for the Schwarzschild, as you will do it today in your tutorial. We'll do exactly the same thing. Now you start with the Schwarzschild metric instead of the Rindlow one. But then you'll find that you can do exactly the same way. The only thing is that A gets replaced with the surface gravity kappa. Okay, so for black hole, everything exactly goes through, but now this will be a kappa over 2 pi. That's the derivation of Hawking's result. All right, so for black hole, this will be also true. So now, you can, however, apply the second thing. You can now, so we use the first property of the thermal green function. Now let's calculate the partition function of Rindlow space. Okay, so what do we have to do? We have to calculate the Euclidean action evaluated on our Rindlow metric. Okay, so we have to calculate SE. Oh, very good. So now, moreover, well, this is not a good place to write, so let me write it here. So we want to calculate the action for the Rindlow space. So what is the action? So we already know that there is an Einstein-Hilbert part, right? So that's the piece of the action which we already know. But we also know that that part is screwed up, right? It has the extra boundary terms which contain the derivatives of the metric, and I cannot make these terms to vanish. So actually, you have to kill those terms. You have to make the action principle well-defined. And in order to do that, you have to add an extra boundary term, which kills my unwanted boundary terms there. Okay, so that's the statement. So now, the action. So action calculation. So we know that the action is given by an integral of d4 of x square root of minus g. Well, we want the Euclidean one, so that will be just g, and then r, and then divided by 16 pi g. That's the Einstein-Hilbert action, But that's not well defined. The variational principle is not well posed because we have the problems with the boundary terms. So we also have to kill that. So this is an integration over the space-time, but we also have a boundary term, d omega, which is given by d3 of x, square root of the metric on the boundary. And then what stands here is the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. And so that's the extra. So this is the Einstein-Hilbert part, And this is the Gibbons-Hawking term. I think it's a minus sign. Gibbons-Hawking. Okay. And so what K here is the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. So extrinsic curvature. And there's a simple, super simple formula, is that the boundary has some normal and mu. Okay, so K is just the covariant derivative of the boundary. Of course, this is a divergence formula, so we can also calculate it as square root of G, and mu, partial mu. Right, this is the normal to the boundary. All right. So this all will be derived in the gravitational physics course, so don't worry about that. So you will precisely see that this is the term you need to add so that you can cancel these unwanted terms in the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay? And this is the prescription for the extrinsic curvature. It basically measures how much your surface boundary is actually curved in the surrounding space. So this thing will be flat, k is zero. But if I start curving that, it won't be flat because my normal is actually changing, and so it's okay, will be non-trivial there. It's really, you know, how much curved the surface is in my spacetime. All right. So now we have to evaluate that, right? So we want to calculate this Euclidean action for our Rindorf space. Okay. What about the first term? What do you think? What about the Einstein-Hilbert action?
Zero because it's flat.
Zero because it's flat, exactly. So Rindorf space is flat, right? So R is zero. So this does not contribute. And all we have to calculate is this boundary term here. Okay, so in other words, all we have to calculate is this extrinsic curvature. Okay, so for that, we really need to introduce the boundary to our Rindorf space. Okay, so the Rindorf space looks like this, right? And so it has some constant x things here. So let's just cut it off by x equal to x something. Okay, so we cut it off. So we introduce a boundary, introduce a boundary at x equal to, I don't know, x zero. And only consider, you know, the range of x to be from minus 1 over a to x 0. So that will be our manifold with boundary now. All right. So then, what is the normal to this boundary, right? So we have the coordinates t, x, and y, and z, right? So now we are introducing a boundary at x equal to x 0. So this is our boundary. Right? So the normal is something like this, that boundary. And so the normal will just have, will be zero everywhere, but it will be one in the x direction. It's directly. So the normal and mu in the coordinates t, x, y, and z, it looks like one, well, zero, 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 one, zero, zero. Right? This is the t direction, this is the x direction. This is the y direction, this is the z direction. That's how our normal looks like. Okay. What is the determinant of the Rindorf space? We have the Rindorf space here. So the Rindorf space is just, So we are, of course, this is evaluated on the Euclidean solution. So we are using this metric here, right? We are using this metric here. So what is the determinant of this thing? 1 plus ax squared. If I take a square root of that, it's just 1 plus ax. OK, so what stands here is just I put 1 plus ax. OK, and mu is only non-trivial when mu is equal to x. OK, so this will be 1. And then I differentiate that with respect to x. And then I do 1 over square root of g, which is 1 plus ax, right? And then in the end, of course, I have to evaluate that on the boundary. So anyway, so what is it I'm getting here? So I just differentiate 1 plus ax divided by x, which is just a, right? So I have the result is a divided by 1 plus ax0 when you are on the boundary. Okay, so that's what the extrinsic curvature is, and it's even correct. So now, what is our Euclidean action? It's stopped working. Okay, very good. You finally broke it. It was the purpose of the last lecture, right? To break the blackboard again. So let's calculate this Euclidean action. So SE is given simply by a three-dimensional integral. So SE is equal to minus 1 over 8 pi g, three-dimensional integral. So what we are doing, we are calculating on the boundary, right? So we set x equal to x0. So our metric is the metric where x is a constant, so this term is not there. So the only remaining coordinates are tau, y, and z. Yeah?
Does the boundary include the horizon too, or?
No, because we know. We basically, no, because there is no horizon anymore. There is just this origin of the coordinates. Remember, we are saying the horizon is located at r equal to, rho equal to 0, right? Which was like our, this thing here. But then we made it regular. So the horizon is just one point now, right? Which is a regular point of your manifold. So there is no boundary on the horizon.
So, the boundary is like, it's like just the right side?
Yeah. And because we made the horizon just to shrink to a point in the Euclidean setting, so this would be like the Lorentzian setting, but in the Euclidean setting, we would just have like a cigar or something like that. Okay, we can discuss that more. So anyway, so what the remaining coordinates are d tau, dy, and dz. That's the integral over d3. So now what is the square root of the determinant? So we just said dx equal to 0, so the determinant is still the same, right? It's just 1 plus ax, right? So it's still 1 plus ax 0. And then we found k, which is a over 1 plus ax 0. And that's it, right? So then this term cancels that term. And you find that this is equal to, there's a minus sign. It's minus a over 8 pi g. OK. What is the integral over d tau? OK. What did we do in the first point? We said, well, in order this to be regular, our time has to be periodic with periodicity beta. So now our time, tau, goes only from 0 to beta. So the integral over tau is just beta. OK, so this is beta. And then we have integral over dy and dz. And let's call it the area of the remaining perpendicular directions. OK, so let me conclude that our Euclidean action is just minus a beta area divided by 8 pi g. OK, so that's our calculation of the Euclidean action. But then we want the free energy. The free energy is just Euclidean action divided by beta. Okay, so the free energy is just minus AA divided by 8 pi g. And you can write it as it's minus A over 2 pi and then A over 4. And you know from the previous calculation that this is the temperature. So this is minus dA over 4. Okay. So now you calculate the entropy. It's dF over dT with a minus sign. What do you get? Area over 4. So that's the derivation of the fact that really the Mindler horizon can be ascribed an entropy just given by the area over 4. If you did the calculation for the black hole, it would be basically the same thing for Schwarzschild black hole. R is still equal to 0, so the Einstein-Hilbert action part does not contribute. Then the Gibbons Hawking part will contribute, but it will give you the right result, but unfortunately it will also give you an infinity. Okay, so then you have to regularize this infinity and renormalize this infinity, and you extract a finite result. Then you get your Euclidean action, calculate dF over dt, and you find that it's given by area over 4 for the horizon of the black hole. Okay, so this is one sneaky derivation of these results, right? So this is a sneaky derivation, sneaky and simple. That's why people really like it, derivation of the fact that black holes have entropy of the fact that both the Rindler horizon can be assigned entropy and temperature, and the black hole horizon can be assigned a temperature, that black holes have temperature and entropy.
So in Grignard space, the temperature is observed by the static observer.
So this temperature will be up. So this is, well, the observer who's sitting at x equal to 0 is moving with the acceleration a. It is this observer who sees the temperature.
Okay. So what about the black hole? Infinite static observer.
So for the black hole, it's slightly more complicated. So for the black hole, the temperature which you derive by this formula here is the temperature measured by a distant observer. Okay. So the observer who is actually sitting on the horizon would see an infinite temperature. But again, you have to achieve this temperature. You have to go to infinity to see a finite amount of temperature. All right, so I have only a couple of minutes. Is that okay? So now this is, I hope I convince you at least there is some kind of calculation backing up Hawking's calculation. There's many other derivations. And so in the end, if you add all these, you know, sort of independent calculations, then you start believing that maybe black holes do have temperature and entropy. This has not been, of course, measured because the astrophysical black holes. So if you look at again at the temperature, right? So the temperature was surface gravity over 2 pi. And when we calculated at the beginning for Schwarzschild black hole, it was something like 1 over m, right? So recall that the temperature, which is something like kappa, and we calculated at the beginning that the kappa goes like 1 over m. So this goes like 1 over m. So first strange thing which you notice is that if you send more energy to the black hole, if you increase the black hole mass, what happens with the temperature? it decreases. Okay, that's very unusual for thermodynamic systems. Typically, if you send more energy to the system, you heat it up, and the temperature increases. Black hole is precisely opposite. What it means is that actually a specific heat of black hole is negative. This is one peculiar feature to notice. Second thing is that you may be asking, okay, so if black hole radiates away at this temperature, of course it radiates away, so the particles, it radiates away the mass, energy, so its mass has to be decreasing. So how long it actually takes for the black hole to completely evaporate? Okay, so then you may be asking, so black hole eventually evaporates completely. So now the rate of energy per time, the energy is of course the mass, so dm over dt, that's the change of the mass of the black hole. Well, okay, so it's given by the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Sigma t to the 4 times the area of the black hole. Okay, the area of the black hole goes like r square. R square goes like 1 over temperature square. So anyway, so this whole thing goes like 1 minus m square. Okay. What it means is that you can integrate this relation, dm over dt is minus 1 over m square, and you find a beautiful cubic relation. So you find that the time is actually something like m over the solar mass 2 power cube. Okay, so if you measure the mass in solar masses, it's m over m solar mass time cube, times a teeny tiny time factor, which is 10 to 71 seconds. Okay, so that's the time it would take for a black hole of solar mass to actually completely evaporate. So now if you compare that to the age time of the universe, lifetime of the universe, this is much, 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 much bigger than the lifetime of the universe. So actually, black holes do evaporate, but it takes really, really long time for them to completely evaporate. All right? Of course, the smaller the black hole you start with, the bigger the temperature, the faster it evaporates. If you have teeny tiny black holes, they evaporate super quickly. Okay, that was the feature people were looking for to see in CERN if the black holes were produced by proton collisions. So if you actually did form teeny tiny black holes by colliding two protons, they would be so small that the temperature would be super huge that you would basically see a burst of Hawking radiation in your detector. And that's what people were looking for, but they didn't see it. Okay, so this would be the lifetime. Of course, then the question is also, and that's the biggest question here, is what happens after the black hole evaporates? So now, you have probably heard about quantum entanglement, and you know that if you throw something in and something stays out, there's always an entanglement between what is thrown in the black hole and what stays out, right? So now, if what goes inside the black hole is eaten by the singularity, basically, you lose an information. You start with a pure state, and you end up with a mixed state. This is the information paradox. Okay, so information paradox, which is one of the biggest questions regarding the black holes, is basically, how can information get lost inside the black hole? And so there is many answers. So people believe that maybe actually it doesn't get lost, but there are still people who believe that it gets lost. And I think it's very instructive to read what those people have to say. So I refer you to a very nice archive review, 1703-021-40 by Andrew and Bob Wald, where they basically analyze what's happening with the information paradox. And then they also, comment on what are the alternatives to the fact that the information doesn't get lost. What do you have to do in order the information doesn't get lost in the end? And it's quite instructive because they basically find that all the other possibilities that it doesn't get lost are very improbable. But of course, this remains to be seen. All right, so let me stop here. We are running out of time. So I hope I convince you that general relativity is a beautiful theory. It has the most beautiful equations in theoretical physics, the Einstein equations. It really tells you that the geometry on the left-hand side is equal to the matter on the right-hand side, right? And then these two equations actually play a double agent role. They contain the information about the motion of matter as well as about how the gravity actually evolves in the presence of matter. The most beautiful equations in there. So another thing is that I hope that I convince you that this is a very well-tested theory. So there is, you know, the general relativity passed so many tests, which it was even not supposed to pass. But anyway, so it started with the perihelion of Mercury. It went through the light bending and the corresponding measurement by Eddington. It went through the gravitational redshift measured by Pound and Repka. It went through the observation of energy loss due to gravitational waves in a binary system. And finally, recently, it went to the discovery of gravitational waves. So everything was so far convinced. It may not be the ultimate theory because it cannot be reconciled with quantum gravity at this point. But maybe, you know, it's not quantized in the end. Maybe it is. Who knows? I went to Wikipedia and counted Nobel Prizes for general relativity. Well, if you really push it, there is 8. But then I count also things like discovery of cosmic microwave background, which has really nothing to do with general relativity, but it's related to universe, and universe is related to FRW space-time, which only could be constructed, you know, in the theory of gravity. So of course, there's only 2 direct Nobel Prizes, and these are for gravitational waves. It's the discovery of the pulsar, and it's the direct measurement of the gravitational waves, which are really pure general relativity. So surprisingly, Einstein never did get Nobel Prize for relativity, neither general nor special, right? So he did get Nobel Prize for his nonsense about the radiation, right? So anyway, so I hope you like general relativity, and I hope that I convince you that sometimes it is actually good to stop calculating and start thinking about the elevators. So thank you so much. Thank you.